Associative Economics, Spiritual Activity for the Common Good, by Gary Lamb. Narrated by Michael Whitry. Printed with support from the Waldorf Curriculum Fund. Published by Waldorf Publications at the Research Institute of Waldorf Education, 38 Main Street, Chatham, New York, 12037. Curriculum Series. The Publications Committee of the Research Institute is pleased to bring forward this publication as part of its curriculum series. The thoughts and ideas represented herein are solely those of the author and do not necessarily represent any implied criteria set by Waldorf Publications. It is our intention to stimulate as much writing and thinking as possible about our curriculum, including diverse views. Please contact us at patrice@waldorf-research.org with feedback on this publication as well as requests for future work. Table of Contents. Dedication, Acknowledgements, Preface, From Experience to Insight. Part 1. Context and Background. Chapter 1. The Nature of This Work. Chapter 2. Rudolf Steiner as Social Reformer and Activist. Chapter 3. Economic Renewal, Cosmology, and the Meaning of Life. Part 2. The Threefold Nature of Social Life and Associative Economics. Chapter 4. The Threefold Nature of Social Life. Chapter 5. The Fundamental Social Law, A New Foundation for Economic Life. Chapter 6. The Transformation of the Competitive Market in Capitalism, Bringing an Associative Economy. Part 3. Aspects of the Threefold Nature of Social Life and Associative Economics. Chapter 7. Trans-Sector Economic Associations, Earthly and Spiritual Potentials. Chapter 8. Freedom, Funding, and Accountability in Education. Chapter 9. The Economic Necessity for Educational and Cultural Freedom. Chapter 10. Individual and Cultural Freedom. Chapter 11. Rights and Single-Payer Systems for Education and Healthcare. Chapter 12. Economic Indices and Basic Human Needs. Chapter 13. Money and Morality, From Citizens to Supra-Rulers. Chapter 14. True Price. Chapter 15. Egoism and Social Life. Part 4. From Thoughts to Moral Actions. Chapter 16. An Associative Relations Audit as a Means of Transformation. Chapter 17. National Leverage Points. Chapter 18. Local Leverage Points. Chapter 19. Aligning Pedagogy and Finance in a Waldorf School. Chapter 20. From Big Thinking and Small Steps to Systematic Change. Endnotes. Bibliography. Let no one be concerned with his own interests. Let each strive for the good of the other. 1 Corinthians 12. It is given to each and every one to make the working of the Spirit apparent in his own way, always in a positive and furthering sense. 1 Corinthians 12. Let all that is done among you be done in love. 2 Corinthians 16. From the Letters of St. Paul. Acknowledgements. A number of people have helped in the creation and completion of this book. Judith Soleil and Judith Kiley at the Rudolf Steiner Library in Harlemville, New York, provided valuable assistance in obtaining reference materials. I was fortunate to have a number of colleagues who graciously reviewed various chapters as this book progressed. These include John Bloom, Ben Borkowitz, Greg Davis, Robert Karp, Jan Kibler, Patrice Maynard, Christopher Schaefer, and Jim Willits. Several people provided valuable comments after the initial draft was completed, including Hillary Corson, Sarah Hearn, Harry Kretz, Jade Lamb, and Mark Clifton. Special thanks go to Sarah Siborski and Sherry Wildfire for their editing assistance with the final manuscript. I also gratefully acknowledge receiving financial support from the Rudolf Steiner Charitable Trust, the Foundation for Rudolf Steiner Books Incorporated, Jim Freeman, David Andrew Schwartz, Sean Sullivan, and Jim Willits. Finally, I wish to thank the Waldorf Educational Foundation and the publications team from the Association of Waldorf Schools of North America, led by David Mitchell, for the final editing, proofreading, layout, printing, and distribution of this book. Preface: From Experience to Insight. As a general orientation, I will begin by describing some life experiences that have shaped my understanding of social life, including economics, as essentially connected to the spiritual foundations of the human being and the world. What do you do with sick money? In my mid-20s, I went through a brief gambling period. During it, I had an experience regarding the nature of money that has stayed with me the rest of my life. It occurred one summer in the 1970s when I was working for a friend refurbishing his two-story garage. My financial goal was to earn enough money to pay for a year of study abroad that was to begin in the autumn. Other than a few cinder blocks, the garage had no foundation, and as a consequence was slowly sinking into the ground, one side faster than the others. My job was to hand-dig underneath the perimeter of the garage about 4 feet to get below the frost line, create a temporary support system, reinforce the bearing walls, jack up the building as needed until it was reasonably level, and finally build a permanent concrete foundation in the trenches I had dug. The project demanded hard physical labor along with engineering and mechanical ingenuity, and I experienced it as a rewarding challenge. One evening after work, a relative of my friend invited me to join him at a local gambling establishment. Gambling at the time was for me more of an amusement than a means of winning money. That is, until one evening when he informed me that one of the events was rigged. Did I want, he asked, to make some easy money? Well, this sounded like a novel experience, and in a moment of thoughtlessness I said, sure. As it turned out, these rigged events occurred with regularity, and I found myself in a peculiar situation by summer's end, possessing what for me was a lot of money. Throughout the summer, I kept my earnings and my winnings in two separate envelopes. I would, from time to time, take the money out of the envelopes and place it before me in two stacks, side by side. Part of me wanted to merge the stacks of $50 and $100 bills and use it all to finance my year abroad. But looking at each pile, visualizing how I obtained the money, gave me such different feelings that I just couldn't do it. Two words come to mind now that clearly distinguish the two different feelings: healthy and diseased. I experienced the money earned through my labor and ingenuity as filled with life and potential energy. The money gained through illegal gambling seemed infected with a kind of social disease, and I sensed that whatever I would use the latter for would become infected also. This was not only an intellectual conjecture, but a powerful feeling as well. At summer's end, I had to make a decision of whether to merge the two stacks of money. In the end, I couldn't do it. But I was in a dilemma. What should I do with the gambling money? Should I give it away to a charity? Burn it? Toss it out of a car window on a crowded street? Take it back and confess my deed, thus exposing a whole ring of people? There were two issues I wrestled with. One was that I did not earn the money in any meaningful way. The other was that I had engaged in illegal acts of cheating, if not stealing. I surmised that if the money was simply unearned, it could perhaps be redeemed by my giving it to a worthy cause, or even by using it for my own education. But the fact that I essentially stole the money made me feel that I had to give it back somehow. And that is what I decided to do. The last night of the summer, I returned with all my winnings to the place of my ill-gotten gains. I then proceeded to bet and lose my money honestly, until it was all gone. Thus was all the money returned to where it had come from, and my conscience relieved. But the real moral of the story for me was the insight that money has different inherent qualities and potentials, depending on how it is obtained and how and for what it is used. That, for me, was an existential reality. The experiences described in the above story and others that follow are the groundwork for a lifelong involvement in economics. Although I don't consider myself an academic in the traditional sense, I have engaged in a self-directed curriculum of study and observation, along with extensive practical experience in business, agriculture, and education. My path through economics has two parallel tracks. One, the economics of agriculture and food distribution, and two, freedom and funding of education. As will be shown below, these parallel tracks have continuous cross-ties connecting them together. Track 1. Domestic and local economy, agriculture, manufacturing, retailing, and distribution. When I was 5 years old, I had what then was a traumatic experience. My parents, baby sister, and I moved from a rented apartment to our own home on 2 acres outside of a small village in the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. The first time my father took me to visit our new home, I left him conversing with the current owners and went out the back door to look around. I then saw something that thrilled me to the core, a backyard baseball field. At that age, and for many years thereafter, my favorite activity was playing baseball. Nothing else came close. Now, it appeared that I was going to have my own ball field, and I was almost dizzy with excitement. I could see the well-worn base paths. It didn't matter that first and second were rock outcroppings, and there were a couple of poplar trees in right field. As I took all this in, my father came and stood beside me, gazing over the field. I imagined he was having the same vision that I was, until he broke the silence and said, "Yep, this field is going to make a mighty fine vegetable garden." I froze in disbelief. I went into denial. He didn't really say that, I told myself. I tried to calm myself with the idea that he must have been expressing a passing thought. Surely the benefits of having a ball field would win over a vegetable garden. Therefore, I decided to forget his comment and not bring the subject up again. But soon after we moved in, my father hired a local farmer to plow under the whole field. I remember standing at the edge of the field watching the tractor turn over the sod row after row. My soul was crushed. Fortunately, my father's vision of how the land should be used was greater than mine. As it turned out, the vegetable garden became an integral part of our household economy, where I learned gardening skills and to work not just for myself, but for others as well. Our domestic economy was supplemented by a couple of fruit trees in our yard. Also, we foraged for wild blueberries, strawberries, and blackberries, which provided tasty treats in the summer. All surplus food was put in the root cellar, or canned by my mother. I took up hunting and fishing with my father, which added to our food supply throughout the year. In the Adirondacks in the 1950s and 1960s, hunting and fishing were as much matters of livelihood as sport. When I became legally employable at age 14, I began working on area truck farms as a laborer, utilizing the skills I had learned in our home garden. I did this each summer until I was 18 years old. Thus were my early experiences in economy closely related to agriculture and nature. During these years, I was familiar with another type of earth-related economic activity, iron ore mining. The village we lived near was interspersed with mine shafts and ore pits. I remember as a child hearing the rumble and feeling the earth shake when blasting would occur in the mine shafts deep below in the earth. I learned later that one of my uncles had died from one of those blasts. From our yard, I could see across the road and through the trees trains with boxcars laden with crushed ore as they headed to the ore dock on Lake Champlain. Mining was a main source of employment in the Adirondacks from the mid-1800s until the late 1960s, when most of the mining operations were shut down. I experienced directly the devastating effect of widespread unemployment in a community through my neighbors, uncles, aunts, and cousins. During the summers of my college years, I switched from agricultural work to building and construction in my father's firm. I remember the day when I turned 18, when I became old enough to work on construction sites. From one day to the next, I went from earning $1 an hour as a sweatback farm laborer to $3 an hour as a construction worker. It felt odd to be suddenly making the same pay as mature men with families to support. Nevertheless, I was grateful to be able to earn enough each summer to pay my way through college. My summers, working on various construction projects, a hospital radiation center, a university science building, a chapel, a bank, and a union recreation center, provided me with an insider's perspective of the construction industry. This was informed by my college studies, which included structural design and engineering. In addition to my work experience as a laborer, mason tender, and apprentice carpenter, I learned about the whole building process from architectural and engineering design to project bidding and construction through my father, who was often the project superintendent where I worked. I could observe the human intelligence that went into the design of the buildings from an engineering and architectural perspective, as well as the wide range of skills of the various tradesmen. I observed the interplay of company owners, management, and workers, the precise timing and coordination of each phase of construction, the labor-saving and hence money-saving capacity of machinery and technology, and management pressures to stay within projected costs. Following my college years, my first significant employment was with Walita, USA, an anthroposophically based pharmaceutical and body care company. I started out as a shipping clerk and worked my way up to toiletry production manager. Here, I not only continued my involvement with agriculture by overseeing a biodynamic herb garden, but also became involved at various times in processing, quality control, packaging, and distribution of the firm's remedies, body care products, teas, and elixirs. Managing this small manufacturing facility, I experienced directly the efficacy of the division of labor and appropriate technology and the human benefits of a team-oriented work environment. I took pricing and efficiency as an ethical responsibility on behalf of both customers and workers, and experienced the greatest joy when I could increase efficiency without diminishing the high quality of our products or the work environment. We marketed our products primarily through the natural foods industry, and I frequently attended trade shows around the country, which brought me into constant interaction with other producers, processors, and retailers. My next position was retail store manager and assistant farm manager at Hawthorne Valley Farm, a diversified biodynamic farm which has a bakery and a dairy processing facility. The farm distributes its products through farmers' markets in New York City, a multiple-site community-supported agricultural program, an on-the-farm retail store, and natural food distributors. As the main produce buyer for the farm store, I became friends with many local organic and biodynamic farmers, and I learned about their personal, professional, and financial struggles. I also interacted with hundreds of store consumers on a daily basis. Thus, I gained insight into all aspects of a food economy: production, distribution, and consumption. My biggest questions and struggles during this period concerned how these three aspects of the economy could work together in a cooperative way, instead of being in competition with one another, and whether it was possible to be profitable without needing to grow ever larger. It was clear to me and many of my co-workers at that time that organic and biodynamic agriculture could not survive in the conventional market economy based on self-interest and competition. As a radical alternative to conventional agriculture, they require new economic and social forms, including those involving business and land ownership, finance, and consumer relations. Track 2. Business, Education, and Spiritual Life. In my third year of college, I reached an emotional rock bottom. It was in the early 1970s. The Vietnam War was in full swing. There were protest marches in the streets and drug busts on campus. I had been raised in a Christian tradition, but my fellow students convinced me, through intellectual deftness, that there was no God. My courses of study, while profound, appeared to have no inner connection. Marxism, which held no appeal for me, seemed to be the only alternative to exploitive capitalism. My fractured soul was a reflection of a fractured world. Then a friend suggested I read a book by the anthroposophist Rudolf Steiner. All the titles sounded like the world of religion or spirituality that I had recently rejected as a non-reality. I resisted reading any at first, but eventually ordered one called Knowledge of Higher Worlds. The introductory sentences riveted me, beginning with, "There slumber in every human being faculties by means of which he can acquire for himself a knowledge of higher worlds. There remains only one question, how to set to work to develop such capacities." Footnote 1. I sensed here a religion and spirituality without the dogma, something that would reveal the interconnectedness of the human being and the surrounding world. At age 26, my obligations to family and country were fulfilled. My mother, whom I had been caring for, had passed away from a brain tumor, and I had completed a 2-year conscientious objector duty in a hospital. I decided to work practically with the spiritual insights of anthroposophy. Waldorf education and biodynamic agriculture were among such possibilities. I opted to train as a Waldorf teacher, even though I had never set foot in a Waldorf school. I visited the Waldorf School of Garden City, situated on the campus of Adelphi University, which offered a master's degree in Waldorf education at that time. The secretary of the school gave me a personal tour, even though the school was closed for Easter vacation. I saw the children's workbooks and artwork and learned about the curriculum that educated the whole child, placing equal emphasis on the capacities of thinking, feeling, and willing, fostered creativity and imagination, and provided for a balance between art and science. I felt deeply the contrast of all this with my own education and the resulting inadequacies. At the end of the tour, she asked me if I would like to join the teacher training program. I said, "No, I don't feel qualified. I'd rather join the kindergarten." For me, this response was not a joke. In my early 30s, I became bedridden with pneumonia and was out of work for a month. I remember lying in bed thinking that I could not get up until I found a new motivation in life. I wasn't dissatisfied with what I was doing. It was enjoyable and had meaning and ideals behind it. But something had changed. I felt I needed a new or an additional calling. But what was it? Not the only thing I could do in my condition was read. So I began reading books by Rudolf Steiner, at first randomly looking for hints, for something that would speak to me as a message in a passage or a title. Eventually I started to see a pattern, as certain thoughts coalesced around Rudolf Steiner's social threefolding ideas. I could feel the excitement and energy that comes with discovery, the discovering of what I began to see as my life's work. I was sure now that my task had something to do with individual freedom and education, which had something to do with money and business. Money? Education? Freedom? Business? How did these relate? Out of this swirl of thoughts, I formed the idea that I should start my own business that would fund an independent school that could be financially accessible to all. It would educate children to be free, creative human beings who would change the world of business. I got out of bed, returned to work, and announced my resignation. I was moving on. Cross ties. How the chapter contents emerged. Rudolf Steiner, Anthroposophy, and Social Threefolding in Connection to Economic and Social Renewal. These are the key and inspiration for all my social endeavors, including this book. In particular, I have studied and discussed in group contexts the essence and practical applicability of what Rudolf Steiner called the fundamental social law and its corollaries in various fields of social life. This law, as will be elaborated in this book, posits cooperation and care for others as the foundation for a socially responsible, associative economy. It is as fundamental to such an economy as the principles of competition and self-interest are to the modern market economy. It is also an ancient spiritual tenet from which all of Steiner's social ideas can be derived. The content of Chapter 6 on the transformation of the competitive market and capitalism is based on the 12th grade economics courses that I taught at four Waldorf schools over 13 years. Teaching by analogy is a recommended Waldorf method for the high school years. I did so by having the students do a comparative study of socialism, capitalism, and the modern market economy, and an associative economy in a threefold social organism. Illustration 2, typical of our coursework, provides such a comparison. During the course, we also had another column to take into consideration, the socialist perspective. Much of the material in Part 3 on education is based on my experiences in the independent Waldorf school movement as a parent, admissions director, development director, and high school teacher. I also drew upon my experiences as the director of the Hope Through Education, a privately funded voucher program that helped families to send their children to private schools, and my experiences as a founding board member of Teach NYS, a lobby organization that advocates for education tax credits in New York State. The associative relations audit presented in Chapter 16 emerged from my work with managers at Hawthorne Valley Farm in the effort to find new ways to work more associatively within the organization and with other businesses.